Am I supporting Marianne Williamson for president? No, I'm not. But that doesn't mean I don't think she should run or that she should be silenced or whatever the case may be. Criticize me if you disagree with what I actually believe, not random musings that are about things I've never said. info@davidpakman.com. You might be featured in next week's Friday feedback Friday, etc. We've got a great bonus show for you today. Sign up at joinpakman.com. We start today with Donald Trump's CNN town hall. We are going to talk about how CNN handled it. We will talk about reaction to the town hall from Trump supporters. We will talk about reaction to the town hall from Republicans and Democrats in elected office and from other networks. But we have to start with the town hall itself, which was 2 hours of Trump lying uncontrollably, calling the host Caitlin Collins nasty and telling the same corrosive greatest hits detrimental to American democracy that we have seen him tell for years now, with some pushback from Caitlin Collins, but a structure that was completely unprepared for the absurdity and insanity of the event at the very top level. MSNBC put together this sort of highlight list, which included Trump continuing to say he really won 2020, saying that E. Jean Carroll made up a fake story and is a whack job. Remember, a jury found that Trump sexually assaulted her, called the moderator Caitlin Collins a nasty person, complimented Vladimir Putin, refused to side with Ukraine in that invasion of Ukraine by Russia, defended keeping classified documents at Mar-a-Lago, pushed Republicans to default on the U.S. debt, and said he was inclined to pardon a bunch of the January 6th rioters. We're talking about criminals. Let's get right into it, because there is just so, I can't cover even everything that was lied about because there were so many lies. But let's start. Trump found liable of sexual assault the day before, and then the next day gets a prime time. Oh, it might have been a 1 hour. Now I don't remember if it was 1 or 2 hours. I watched it in an accelerated format after the fact. Standing ovations from a sycophant audience, and Trump arguably admitting to criminality during this event. Trump asked, those classified documents, did you show them to anyone? And Trump says, not really, which I think means, yes, he did.
When it comes to your documents, did you ever show those classified documents to anyone?
Not really. I would have the right to. By the way, they were declassified.
What do you mean, not really?
Not that I can think of. Let me just tell you, I have the absolute right to do whatever I want with them.
Now understand, not really isn't no, and immediately saying not really, but I could definitely do it if I wanted to, sounds like he is saying yes. Another one of the most notable moments was when he called Caitlin Collins a nasty person. Now, when I do my analysis of how this was handled, you can simultaneously realize Caitlin Collins tried to do a good job, and when she pressed Trump, he insulted her. But also the way that this was generally handled by CNN was a disaster. This is sort of the epitome of that. When she actually tries to press Trump, he just insults her.
Why you held on to those documents when you knew the federal government was seeking them and then had given you a subpoena to return them?
Are you ready? Are you ready? Can I talk?
Yeah, what's the answer?
Do you mind?
I would like for you to answer the question.
Okay, it's very simple to answer.
That's why I asked it.
It's very simple to, you're a nasty person, I'll tell you.
And of course, the sycophant crowd cheers. Attack. Think about this. This event embodies the downfall of journalism, but in more than one way. It's the downfall of journalism in that CNN was in way over its head and completely unprepared structurally to handle the uncontrollable lies flowing out of Trump's mouth like projectile vomiting. They were unprepared to do that. That's a problem, right, in journalism. But also, it's the continued attacks on journalism, where when you attack the moderator who's doing their job or trying to, your supporters cheer. Wee! Trump's insulting the person asking questions. really sad on many, many levels. The topics came up related to the 2020 election and Caitlin Collins. Again, she tries to confront Trump with the reality that the things he's saying, even Republicans say, aren't true about the 2020 election. And he just steamrolled.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now! Erdogan!
Despite all his smear campaigns and insults, Erdogan did not get the result he expected. Nobody should get excited, but a fait accompli.
Turkey appears to be headed for a presidential runoff that could put an end to Tayyip Erdogan's 20 years in power. We'll go to Istanbul for the latest. Then a ceasefire has been reached in Gaza after Israel killed 33 Palestinians over 5 days.
The ceasefire is good for us. We can return to life, fishing, working, and breathing again. We can move in and out and try to make a living from fishing and to move around without being harassed.
The ceasefire in Gaza comes as Palestinians mark the 75th anniversary of what they call the Nakba, the Arabic word for catastrophe, when over 700,000 Palestinians fled or were violently expelled from their homes in 1948 when Israel was founded. We'll speak to two Palestinians who've traveled to New York as the United Nations today officially commemorates the Nakba for the first time. We'll also speak with Peter Beinart of Jewish Currents.
There are powerful forces in this Israeli government that would like to try to bring about another mass expulsion. A whole series of ministers in this Israeli government have talked favorably about the idea of an effort to remove large numbers of Palestinians from the West Bank or even from Israel proper.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Turkey, the closely watched election that will determine whether President Recep Tayyip Erdogan will remain in power appears headed to a May 28th runoff, as Erdogan fell just short of the 50% of votes needed to win outright. Erdogan's two-decade-long grip on power was challenged by the leading opposition candidate, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, who vowed closer ties with NATO and the European Union and to reinforce democratic institutions. A third candidate, a right-wing challenger, received about 5% of the vote. The election comes at a time when many Turks are grappling with rising living costs and residents in the south of Turkey are still reeling from February's tragic earthquakes. We'll go to Istanbul for the latest. In another highly anticipated election in Thailand, voters decisively rejected the ruling military-backed government, which came to power in a 2014 coup, voting in large numbers for the youth-led reformist opposition Move Forward Party and the populist Thu Thai Party, controlled by the billionaire Shinawatra family. The two parties have agreed to form a coalition with other groups, though they'll have to contend with rules established by the military, which gives the junta significant power. This is Move Forward leader Pita Lamjaroenrat.
The sentiment of the era has changed, and it's right. It was the right timing that people have been through enough of lost decade in the past decade, and today is a new day.
Move Forward has vowed to reform Thailand's lèse majesté laws, which saw people arrested and jailed for insulting the monarchy following mass youth-led protests in 2020 calling for reforms to the royal system. Ukraine says at least 4 people were killed today and a hospital was hit in a Russian missile attack in the Donetsk city of Avdiivka. This comes as Ukraine's military said it's made advances in the devastated eastern city of Bakhmut, pushing back Russian forces, though Russia still retains control over the majority of the area. Earlier today, Russia said 2 senior military officers were killed in the eastern Donetsk region, which is home to Bakhmut. Over the weekend, the Washington Post reported recently leaked U.S. intelligence shows the head of the Russian mercenary Wagner group, Yevgeny Prigozhin, offered in January to give Ukraine's military military the location of Russian troops to attack if it pulled back Ukrainian forces from Bakhmut. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is in the UK, where the British government pledged long-range attack drones for Kyiv's fight against Russia's invasion. The visit comes as part of a whirlwind European tour over the weekend, where Zelensky met with Pope Francis at the Vatican and Italian leaders in Rome, followed by stops in Germany, which pledged nearly $3 billion in new military aid, and France, which promised more armored tanks. The Israeli army and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad in Gaza agreed to an Egyptian-brokered ceasefire Saturday after 5 days of fighting in which at least 33 Palestinians, including children, were killed. One Israeli was killed. Many Gazans were facing the loss or destruction of their homes after Israel's air raid campaign, as well as the trauma of the attacks. This is a young girl in Gaza.
My childhood feelings and dreams were all in this house. I was brought up in this house. I used to have fun, study, and play here, and all my siblings' toys were in it. We lived the most beautiful days of our lives here, but when they destroyed it, we do not know where to go.
In the occupied West Bank, three Palestinians were reported killed during Israeli raids in or near Nablus in recent days. This all comes as Palestinians mark the 75th anniversary of what they call the Nakba, when hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, over 700,000, were forcibly expelled from their homes before and during the formation of the State of Israel in 1948. In Burma, at least six people were reported dead after a powerful cyclone made landfall on Sunday. Cyclone Moka is one of the most powerful storms to hit the region. Several hundred Rohingya refugee shelters were torn apart, while the capital of the northwestern Rakhine State was almost completely destroyed. Power and communication lines have been disrupted, with aid workers struggling to reach areas in need. The cyclone also triggered massive floods and landslides in neighboring Bangladesh. In Kenya, the death toll from the starvation cult Good News International Church has risen to 201, many of them children. The apocalyptic cult's leader, Paul McKenzie, is accused of ordering his followers to starve themselves and their children to death. A commission is investigating whether oversight by administrative or intelligence authorities played any role. In Guatemala, the prominent investigative newspaper, El Periodico, is closing after months of intensifying harassment and persecution from the right-wing government of President Alejandro Giammattei. Founder José Rubén Zamora remains in detention after nearly 1 year, accused of money laundering and other charges that human rights and press freedom groups have denounced as political retaliation over exposés of government corruption. Zamora's trial began earlier this month. Meanwhile, several of El Periodico's journalists and columnists are also being investigated by Guatemalan authorities. The newspaper laid off most of its staff and shut down its print edition in November. In immigration news, government officials confirmed Friday a 17-year-old unaccompanied migrant teen died at a U.S. Health and Human Services facility in Florida earlier this month. Angel Eduardo Mardiaga Espinosa, who was from Honduras, was found unconscious and later pronounced dead at a local hospital. The Honduran government is demanding an investigation into his death. Meanwhile, the teen's mother says she's received no information about the cause of death. Espinosa reportedly had epilepsy. CBS News reports this is the second death of an unaccompanied migrant child under the Biden administration. A 4-year-old child from Honduras died in March in HHS custody after being hospitalized for cardiac arrest. That death was not previously reported by government officials. Alabama Republican Senator Tommy Tuberville has come under fire for comments defending white nationalists and the Pentagon's efforts to rid them from its ranks. He made the comments last week while talking to NPR's Alabama-based station WBHM.
You mentioned the Biden administration trying to prevent white nationalists from being in the military. Do you believe they should allow white nationalists in the military?
Well, they call them that. I call them Americans.
Tuberville and his team have since unsuccessfully tried to walk back the comments. Tuberville told NBC's Julie Serkin, quote, "I look at a white nationalist as a Trump Republican," unquote. Tuberville was already under fire for holding up military nominees over a Pentagon policy which covers paid leave for workers who have to travel out of state to get an abortion. Tuberville also said the fact that a jury found Donald Trump liable for the sexual abuse and defamation of E. Jean Carroll, quote, "makes me want to vote for him twice," unquote. In related news, the Washington Post is reporting suspected Pentagon leaker Jack Teixeira was obsessed with guns and was preparing for a race war. Videos and chat logs show the 21-year-old National Guard member viewed black people, liberals, Jews, and LGBT people as enemies and threats he may have to fight. In Buffalo, New York community members and loved ones gathered Sunday to commemorate the victims of last year's massacre at Top Supermarket, in which a white supremacist shot dead 10 black people. Governor Kathy Hochul, Attorney General Letitia James, and Senator Chuck Schumer attended the one-year remembrance. North Carolina's Democratic Governor Roy Cooper vetoed a Republican-led bill banning nearly all abortions after 12 weeks, setting up an likely override vote. Republicans have a supermajority in the North Carolina legislature, but it would only take one defector to keep the veto in place. Governor Cooper signed the veto at an abortion rights rally in Raleigh on Saturday, which 2,000 people attended. This is reproductive rights advocate Janice Robinson speaking.
We do not appreciate what the Republicans have done in trying to take away our rights, passing this monster bill that is going to make it so much harder for women to have access to abortion care. And if the legislatures do not sustain this veto, we will definitely make sure that there are people elected that are about protecting women's rights when it comes to the election in 2024.
In Texas, a woman was shot dead by her boyfriend after she returned from traveling to Colorado to get an abortion where the procedure remains legal. Abortions are banned in Texas. Police say Harold Thompson, who's been arrested and charged with murdering 26-year-old Gabriela Gonzalez, did not want her to terminate her pregnancy. Florida's education officials blocked dozens of textbooks and forced publishers to edit dozens of others to remove information on racial and social justice issues. This comes as part of Republican Governor Ron DeSantis's ongoing campaign criminalizing the teaching of critical race theory, LGBTQ topics, and other issues he describes as, quote, woke indoctrination. One middle school textbook no longer includes a section on Black Lives Matter and the police murder of George Floyd. Meanwhile, DeSantis has signed into law a bill that will allow health care providers and insurers to deny patient care on the basis of religious or moral beliefs. Human rights advocates say the legislation will lead to more discrimination against LGBTQ people. In San Francisco, the transgendered community and loved ones of slain activist Banco Brown are calling for justice for the late 24-year-old black trans man. Brown was shot dead outside a Walgreens by a security guard in April after he allegedly tried to steal snacks from the store. The shooter has not been charged. Banco Brown's loved ones say he suffered from food and housing insecurity in a city known for its vast inequalities. And here in New York, Daniel Penny, the ex-Marine who choked beloved street performer Jordan Neely to death while on the subway, was arraigned Friday on a charge of second-degree manslaughter and freed pending trial. Neely's family blasted the charge as overly lenient for the unprovoked killing in which Penny used a technique known to be lethal. Before he was killed, Jordan Neely was crying out he was hungry and thirsty and may have been suffering a mental health crisis. This is Dante Mills, an attorney for the Neely family.
No one on that train asked Jordan, what's wrong? How can I help you? He was choked to death instead. So for everybody saying, I've been on the train and I've been afraid before, and I can't tell you what I would have done in that situation, I'm going to tell you. Ask how you can help. Please. Don't attack. Don't choke. Don't kill. Don't take someone's life. Don't take someone's loved one from them because they're in a bad place.
Jordan Neely's funeral is scheduled for Friday in Harlem. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, Turkey appears to be headed for a presidential runoff that could put an end to Tayyip Erdogan's 20 years in power. Back in a minute. DACA system by 47 Soul. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Turkey's presidential election appears to be headed to a runoff in 2 weeks. Preliminary results show Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan received 49.4% of the vote. His main challenger, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, received just under 45%. The two candidates will likely face each other in a second round of voting on May 28th. Kılıçdaroğlu campaigned on a vow to end what he called Erdogan's authoritarian rule. Erdogan has been in power for 20 years, first as prime minister, then as president. On Sunday, Erdogan spoke to a crowd outside the AK Party headquarters in Ankara.
If the decision of our nation shows that the elections have been completed, then there is no problem. Elections for the lawmakers of the Grand National Assembly of Turkey resulted in Our People's Alliance winning the majority. Currently, the majority in the parliament is in Our People's Alliance. Our alliance dominates almost all commissions. Therefore, we do not doubt that the choice of our nation, which gave the majority in the parliament to our alliance, will be in favor of trust and stability in the presidential election.
Earlier today, Erdogan's challenger, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, said he would prevail in the runoff.
Despite all his smear campaigns and insults, Erdogan did not get the result he expected. Nobody should get excited, but a fait accompli. Elections are not won on the balcony. Election data still continues to come in. If our nation decides on a runoff, with our pleasure, we'll definitely win this election in the second round. Everyone will see it.
For more, we go to Istanbul, Turkey, where we're joined by Kaya Genç, an award-winning Turkish essayist and historian. He's the author of several books, including most recently The Lion and the Nightingale, A Journey Through Modern Turkey. He's covered the Turkish elections for the London Review of Books. His recent article for The Nation is headlined The Political Aftershock of Turkey's Devastating Earthquake. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Kaya Genç. Can you start off by talking about the significance of this runoff and that it is likely going to a runoff on May 28th?
This was a total shock because we were expecting a clear opposition victory. All the polls were pointing to that direction. And so we were preparing to write the political obituary of Recep Tayyip Erdogan, Turkey's president for 2 decades. But Erdogan made a stunning comeback, and that was a total blow for people in Istanbul. Istanbul voted predominantly for the opposition. But when you look at the whole country, the whole ballots opened. Now it seems like we've been mistaken in the polls. And Erdogan has a 5-point lead. And the third candidate in the presidential race is also a right-wing figure whose supporters are more likely to support Erdogan. So if he gets that 5% as well, it will be an easy, comfortable win for Erdogan for the next elections. But this was a total shock for the Turkish establishment because for months Erdogan was never speaking optimistically about the election results. He was his usual self, bombastic rhetoric, muscular nationalism, but he never said we're going to win definitely. This is what the opposition said. The opposition was very certain that this was the end of Erdogan, that we were getting rid of him in the first round. And so yesterday, there was huge disappointment, and the supporters of the opposition felt a little bit betrayed because after hours, when the first results came, the opposition leaders were nowhere to be seen. They made very brief appearances during the night. But very brief appearances that gave no hope to the voters whatsoever. So this morning, we woke up to a very frustrated city. People feel betrayed and fooled by the pollsters. And I don't know if the opposition will gather enough energy to prepare for the runoff in 2 weeks.
So tell us about who the opposition leader is, Kamal Kılıçdaroğlu. Talk about he himself and also the movement that came together to try to defeat Erdogan.
Sure. So Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu is an Alevi, a short, well-mannered, softly spoken Alevi, a grandfatherly figure who is the anti-Erdogan. He speaks in a very civilized way. He never gets angry. He's very calculating. And he seems a very civilized man. So, and he's the leader of the CHP, the Republican People's Party, which is, of course, the founder of modern Turkey, a century-long party, a century-old party. And so Kılıçdaroğlu played the role of a mediator, a middleman. And he said, we're going to change the direction of the CHP. We're going to make peace with the religious people. We are going to make peace with the Kurds. We are going to get the support of the nationalists. We are going to be the centerpiece of the anti-Erdogan movement. And that he did very diligently and for months. So he went into meetings. He convinced five other opposition parties to form an alliance. And he called it the National Alliance. And then he also received the support of the Kurds and the far left and the environmentalists. So 13 parties in total supported his bid. So at the one hand, we have these 13 parties and Kılıçdaroğlu as their candidate, always saying the right things, culturally, politically, saying nothing politically incorrect. And then we had Erdogan and his coalition, which was a far-right coalition. And we have to be honest, the winner of yesterday's vote was the far-right in Turkey. And so these are different shades of far-right. One party called Yeniden Refah, which is a very religious party. Another one, a Kurdish religious party. So we thought that Kılıçdaroğlu, a Biden-like figure, white-haired, a bit boring, but a peacemaker, would steal the vote from the extremities of Turkish politics. But we were very badly mistaken. This was a huge win for the extremist movements. And people, when Kılıçdaroğlu, the opposition candidate, announced his bid in March, some people said, this man will never do the job, he will not win, because we need someone as tall and angry and rabble-rousing as Erdogan to beat him. But the opposition party, the CHP, said, no, we'll be very calm, this is the man. And now I think the people who opposed Kılıçdaroğlu's candidacy, maybe in 2 weeks, we'll say we were proven right. We need someone a bit more like Erdogan to beat Erdogan. So now the opposition, unfortunately, will spend the next few weeks, I think, debating this issue. Did we pick the right candidate? What could we do right? What did we do wrong? Of course, these will help little to win the second round for them. So this will be a frustrating 2 weeks for the opposition. And Erdogan now has the full wind of the Turkish political system in his sails. And he made a speech yesterday. He made it clear that this was a definite win for him. But he fell short of announcing a victory in the first round. So he played his cards right. 3 years ago, in the mayoral elections in Istanbul, the candidate that he picked for Istanbul just rushed to the cameras and said, we won in the first round. And then the opposition candidate, the mayoral candidate for Istanbul, won a few hours later. So Erdogan didn't make this mistake. He didn't rush things.
And he seemed confident that he'll win the elections in the second round. So the problem is, Kılıçdaroğlu was 100% confident that he would win in the first round. And how will he be able to explain to his voters that he made a miscalculation and that he can win certainly, clearly, definitely in the second round?
Given his authoritarian rule, Erdogan, his enormous power that he's gained over 20 years, do you believe the results of the election? That's number one. And talk about the crisis of the economy in Turkey, not to mention the devastation of the earthquakes in February and how that affected people and how people in Turkey are feeling right now.
Yes, so these two questions are actually related. Erdogan has a huge control of the Turkish media. So if you look at CNN's Turkish edition, it's 24 hours Erdogan propaganda. If you look at most mainstream channels, 24-hour Erdogan propaganda. So he's authoritarian control over the Turkish media. You look at TRT World, for example. You look at all different channels. It's all about Erdogan's rhetoric. And what is Erdogan's rhetoric so far for the past 2 months? It was this. The opposition parties are organized, curated, if you will, by Joe Biden, by the U.S. imperialist system. So he used this very anti-imperialist rhetoric. And he said any vote for the CHP, the founder of the Turkish Republic, was a vote for Joe Biden. So he used this honestly eccentric rhetoric very carefully. And thanks to his authoritarian control over the media, when opposition candidates were attacked with stones during their campaigning in different Anatolian cities, all these TV channels were saying these are self-organized attacks, the opposition parties stoned themselves. This is a whole drama. These are all scenarios implemented by Biden, by the Pentagon. And when Turkish TV channels interviewed people on the street, people were saying exactly the same things. So this was an incredible example of how media could form public opinion in Turkey. And as I've been saying, it's more than 85% of Turkish media under Erdogan's control. So they really managed the whole discourse very well. And to the second question, the economic crisis. In February 6th, when the earthquakes killed more than 50,000 people in Syria and Turkey, with a bill of more than $100 billion, Turkey was already in deep trouble. The inflation had soared, the Turkish lira had melted against the dollar for months, and so Turkey was really in a very difficult position. But Erdogan said, using his incredible media dominance, that we are the builders, they are the critics, they are the talkers, we are the builders, and we will use this huge crisis as a great chance to rebuild Turkey. So he started using the rebuild rhetoric, and he said, who has built stuff for you throughout the 20th century? The Turkish right-wing parties did. And who is the representative of the Turkish right-wing legacy now? It's me and my coalition partners. Okay, maybe we are a bit far to the right of the equation, but trust us, we are the builders, we'll rebuild those houses, but we will not do that for free. You will have to pay for us. We'll give you credit, which will help you pay for your new houses. And of course, those houses were destroyed because of irregularities in the whole construction system. And Erdogan took no responsibility whatsoever. He said, those buildings are gone, drink a glass of cold water and come back to me, vote for me, and let's play this whole game again. And I was listening to lots of supporters of Erdogan in the earthquake-hit cities, 11 of them, and people were saying, the opposition promises to build housing for us for free, but there is no free lunch on earth. We don't believe them. We trust Erdogan because in a capitalist system, we will have to pay for this. So it is a very strange scenario where the people most violently affected by the earthquake were most passionately supporting the government that was responsible for the toll, I think, and all the experts think like that. But they were saying, we want to do this again, we want new houses, you are the only one who can deliver. So Erdogan's message is, the answer to this crisis, this example of crisis capitalism, will help us rebuild this country, will help and live in the economy. So the way out of this crisis is rebuilding these 11 cities. And that's the message he tried to sell, and that's the message he sold, much to our dismay.
Hi, Genç. I want to thank you so much for being with us. Award-winning Turkish essayist and historian, author of several books, including the most recent, The Lion and the Nightingale, A Journey Through Modern Turkey. He covered the Turkish elections for the London Review of Books, and we'll link to your article in The Nation, The Political Aftershock of Turkey's Devastating Earthquake. Coming up, a ceasefire has been reached in Gaza after Israel killed 33 Palestinians over 5 days. The ceasefire comes as Palestinians mark the 75th anniversary of what they call the Nakba, the Arabic word for catastrophe, when over 700,000 Palestinians fled or were violently expelled from their homes in 1948 when Israel was founded. Stay with us. Layla by Clarissa Bitar. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to the occupied Palestinian territories. On Saturday, the Israeli army and the militant group Islamic Jihad agreed to an Egyptian-brokered ceasefire following 5 days of fighting in Gaza, which has been under an Israeli blockade for the past 16 years. Prior to the ceasefire, Israeli forces killed 33 Palestinians in Gaza, including women and children, and at least 147 Palestinians were injured. Meanwhile, Palestinian militants fired over 1,000 rockets into Israel, killing 2 people, an Israeli woman and a Palestinian man from Gaza working in Israel. The latest violence began Tuesday when Israel broke a previous ceasefire. This all comes as Palestinians across the globe are marking today the 75th anniversary of what they call the Nakba, the Arabic word for catastrophe, when well over 700,000 Palestinians fled or were violently expelled from their homes in 1948 when Israel was founded. For the first time, the United Nations is holding a high-level special meeting to commemorate the Nakba today. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., Democratic Congressmember Rashida Tlaib introduced a resolution last week to recognize what she calls the ongoing Nakba and the rights of Palestinian refugees. We're joined by 3 guests. Peter Beinart is editor-at-large of Jewish Currents. His recent piece is headlined, Could Israel Carry Out Another Nakba? He's a professor of journalism and political science at the Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at the City University of New York, CUNY. Also with us, Saleh Hijazi, part of the Palestinian Boycott National Committee. He's the former deputy regional director for the Middle East at Amnesty International. He was a key researcher on their report, Israel's Apartheid Against Palestinians. He's visiting New York from Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Munir Nuseiba is also with us, a human rights lawyer and director of Al-Quds Human Rights Clinic in Jerusalem. Saleh and Munir both arrived in New York on Sunday to attend today's meeting at the United Nations on the Nakba. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! I want to start with Professor Munir Nuseiba. If you can talk about the Egyptian-brokered ceasefire and what this violence of the last weeks has meant.
The violence of the last week is the unfortunate continuation of impunity in Israel. Over the past few decades, since the Nakba, actually, until the current day, Israel has been able to sustain an apartheid regime in Palestine and close Gaza in a siege, prevent people from moving, prevent goods from moving, but also keep the occupation running, keep the displacement and the demolition and the ongoing Nakba, which you mentioned earlier in your introduction. And at the same time, continue with a policy of assassinations, imprisonment, arbitrary imprisonment. And all of these elements have continue causing these small armed conflicts that happen every now and then. But the problem is that with impunity, with no punishment for those who perpetrate war crimes and crimes against humanity, we can only expect these events to continue and to come back again and again and again. Yes, every time there is an escalation like this one, there will be intervention from neighboring countries like Egypt to stop stop this type of military conflict. However, the main problems remain. Gaza is still under siege, and collective punishment of every person who lives in there and every person who also lives outside and who wants to visit Gaza. The West Bank is still occupied. The Israeli regime is applying apartheid in all of the territory of Palestine, Israel. So, unfortunately, while I can say that we're comfortable and happy that the military action has stopped, I would say that there is, you know, this might come back in the future as long as there are no fundamental remedies for the current situation.
In 2018, I interviewed Mahmoud Saleh, a Nakba survivor who was forced out of his home village of Sa'ra in 1948. At the time he spoke to us, he was 86 years old. He was born in a village just outside Jerusalem that was bombed and invaded when he was a teenager in 1948. He described how his family sought refuge in what's now the West Bank. He slept in caves, under trees, moving from refugee camp to refugee camp before the UN eventually sent him on a ship to South America, to Venezuela. Then he went to Colombia. I spoke to him in Chicago, where he lived, and I asked him what that word Nakba, Arabic for catastrophe, means to him.
Nakba means it is a disaster of my heart, a disaster of my family, a disaster of my soul, a disaster of my country, because it is the Nakba, it is the history of my country, of my grandfather, grandmother, and the disaster of my even faith, my religion, my school, it was destroyed. The Nakba, it is a word. It is a very, very strange word, hard word. It is still in my heart, and I give it to my sons. I give it to everybody I know from the family.
Saleh Hejazi, if you could talk about the significance of today at the United Nations, the first time they will commemorate the Nakba, and also talk about your previous work at Amnesty International when last year, for the first time, they talked about Israel as an apartheid state.
Yes, so actually the two, both the UN commemorating the Nakba for the first time and Amnesty International coming and recognizing that the regime that Israel imposes on Palestinians is that of apartheid. It's a regime that treats Palestinians as an inferior racial group and imposes a system of oppression and domination on them with the intention of creating a Jewish supremacist state with as little Palestinians, preferably no Palestinians, within the land of Palestine. Both these are coming to recognize what Palestinians have been saying for many, many years. It's a recognition of the Palestinian narrative that in 1948 we were victims of a planned ethnic cleansing of the indigenous population, the Palestinians in Palestine, and that that event in 1948 continues until today, that we're still facing the same systematic dispossession, displacement, systematic killing. You know, you were mentioning Gaza and the attack on Gaza recently. This is the sixth attack of such gravity against Gaza in since the blockade, the criminal blockade that was imposed on the Gaza Strip since 2007. Last year, according to the UN, over the last 12 months, we've seen the sharpest rise in the killing of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, including many, many children. So these are all symptoms of this system of oppression and domination, of forcible displacement. Now, they are late, but they're, of course, very welcome, though a recognition is not enough. What we need is to tackle the root causes of what is happening. We need the dismantling of this system of oppression and domination. The UN has a responsibility. It has committed itself to addressing the question of Palestine, but it only does that in a kind of a partial way, in a humanitarian way. We need a political addressing of the situation in Palestine. We need the dismantling of settler colonialism and apartheid, Zionist settler colonialism and apartheid. And it starts with ending complicity when it comes to states, institutions, corporations, to isolate apartheid regimes. It's similar, very similar to what happened in Southern Africa when the world stood up to the apartheid regimes that were there in Namibia, in South Africa, and in Zimbabwe. Isolated these regimes, imposed boycotts and sanctions against them. This is what we want the world to do. We want the UN to go down that route of action. And we want also individual states to also end their complicity with the system of oppression and domination in Palestine.
Palestinian American Congressmember Rashida Tlaib, who represents Detroit, recently introduced a resolution to recognize the Nakba. The resolution reads, quote, "The Nakba is not only a historical event, but also an ongoing process characterized by Israel's separate and unequal laws and policies towards Palestinians, including the destruction of Palestinian homes, the construction expansion of illegal settlements, and Israel's confinement of Palestinians to ever-shrinking areas of land," she writes. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy attempted to quash a planned event by Tlaib commemorating the Nakba by preventing it from going ahead in the U.S. Capitol. Instead, she hosted the event in a packed Senate committee room filled with Palestinian rights supporters. The group Democratic Majority for Israel tweeted in response, quote, "The root of the catastrophe, the Arab world refused to accept the UN plan for a Jewish and Arab state in what was left of the UK's Palestine mandate after Jordan's creation. Instead, five Arab armies invaded Israel, attempting to destroy it and push the Jews into the Mediterranean Sea," they said. I wanted to bring Peter Beinart into this conversation. Peter is editor-at-large of Jewish Currents. You recently wrote a piece, Could Israel Carry Out Another Nakba? First, could you respond to both the resolution, what's happening in Israel, as well as that response I just read, and then talk about what you suggest in your piece, Could Israel Carry Out Another Nakba, where you say expulsionist sentiment is common in Israeli society and politics. To ignore the warning signs is to abdicate responsibility, you write. Peter.
Sure. I think the fact that there is even a conversation, an argument about the Nakba taking place in Washington is itself progress. And it owes a great deal to the figure of Rashida Tlaib, who I think is the first American politician in a long time who's been willing to really make an effort to get this commemorated. So it requires people like Kevin McCarthy and groups like Democratic Majority Israel for Israel to have to argue back and try to cancel these events, which in the past they didn't even need to do. And she found an important ally in Bernie Sanders, who's the one who allowed her to use that room in the Senate. The problem with trying to kind of blame Palestinians for their own expulsion and claim it was only a result of Arab armies attacking Israel is, first of all, that a significant number of the roughly 750,000 Palestinians who were expelled or fled in fear between 1947 and 1949 did so before the Arab armies attacked, before Israel declared independence in May 1948. And also because these expulsions didn't end when the war ended. If you read, if you can just read Israeli historians like Benny Morris in his book Israel's Border Wars, he talks about how Israel continued expulsions, albeit at a smaller scale, through into the 1950s. Then Israel expelled a large number of Palestinians again in 1967. So the point of my essay is that while there have been fluctuations in the pace at which Palestinians have been expelled, this has been a continuous process since Israel's creation, because Palestinians have been a problem for Israel. And the basic guiding notion in Israeli politics has been you want to control as much land as possible with as few Palestinians as possible. What I think may be different and worrying about this moment is that you have a critical mass of people in this Israeli government who are on the record as suggesting that they would like to find some way of convincing or coercing large numbers of Palestinians to leave the West Bank, if not Israel proper. It starts with Bezalel Smotrich, the finance minister who is in charge of civil administration, who wrote very explicitly in 2017, essentially, that Palestinians should be given the choice either to accept living under Israeli control without basic rights or to leave. Itamar Ben-Gvir also has spoken in these terms, but some of the Likud ministers as well. Yoav Gallant, the defense minister, Tzachi Hanegbi, the national security advisor, Avi Dichter, the agricultural minister, former head of Shin Bet, the domestic security agency, all of them have essentially suggested, ironically, they don't deny that the Nakba took place in 1948. They acknowledge it and say that it may need to happen again. And I think that if Israel feels utter impunity from the United States and from the rest of the world, it makes it more likely, especially in a context of rising Palestinian armed resistance in the West Bank, that we could get to that terrible moment.
You also wrote a piece on your Substack titled, Is Denying the Nakba Anti-Semitism? Explain what you mean.
Well, that was a play on a speech that Yair Lapid made when he essentially said that anti-Semitism, any form of racism, should be considered anti-Semitism. I think the point that I've tried to make in some of my writing is there's, to me, a very profound irony and tragic irony in the fact that Jews, who we know deeply that preserving memory is the way you maintain a people. The reason that the Jewish people has survived in large measure is because we tell the stories of our history and we preserve a national memory. So when Jewish leaders in Israel or the United States essentially tell Palestinians to forget the Nakba, to get over it, what they are doing is not making a move. That is not a suggestion of peace. That is really a proposal of extinction. Because if you tell a people to forget its history, you are really inviting it to cease to exist. And that's what I find as a Jew so disturbing about this continual Nakba denial that we see in a mainstream American Jewish organization.
I want to bring Salah Nijazi and Professor Munir Nisaiba back into this conversation. Professor Nisaiba, as you come to the UN today, what do you think actually needs to happen and the role of the United Nations in this?
The United Nations had an important role in creating the Nakba, unfortunately. Back in 1947, the United Nations General Assembly recommended the partition of Palestine into two states, responding apparently to the political atmosphere that the United Kingdom, the colonial power present in Palestine at the time, responding to the atmosphere that it created. After that, the Nakba happened, and Israel displaced 80% of the overwhelming, of the Palestinian population that lived in the area that it conquered during that war. These Palestinians have become refugees in different refugee camps in the West Bank, in Gaza, in Jordan, in Egypt, in Lebanon, in Syria, and other places around the world. The General Assembly has resolved already back in 1948 in a resolution that the Palestine refugees should have the right to return. And it has been keeping this resolution and calling for it continuously since then. However, and there have been many other resolutions that contributed to calling for different Palestinian rights. We have a lot of literature, a lot of resolutions from the General Assembly, some resolutions from the Security Council that push for Palestinian rights. However, that we haven't been able to see actual measures taken against Israel in order to force Israel to abide by international law and UN resolutions. And so what we expect and what we hope is that by commemorating the Nakba and by looking and responding to the work of the human rights lawyers and activists, but also the UN Special Rapporteurs who are closely documenting the situation in Palestine, that the UN would start taking measures at a certain point, measures that can be translated into policies that are taken both by the UN but also by individual states. This has been missing. The UN has been also involved in this long, never-ending so-called peace process that started back in the early 90s. And unfortunately, it is evident to us now that this peace process is just serving as a drug for everyone. Everybody is saying, there's a peace process happening now. We don't need to do any intervention. Let's invite all the parties to sit on a table. The parties have sat on tables for very long periods of time. They haven't gotten anywhere. There is a colonial project that is continuing to expand, to build Jewish-only settlements, to implement an apartheid regime between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. And this needs to end. You cannot convince them to give up supremacy only on a negotiating table. Negotiating tables, unfortunately, are not enough for that. What we actually need is concrete actions by the United Nations and by member states of the United Nations, by the International Criminal Court, which has jurisdiction over the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and Gaza Strip, which can start acting. So we need this. We need action.
Let me ask Salah Hijazi, the Israeli Diaspora Affairs and Combating Anti-Semitism Minister, Amichai Chikli, recently sent a letter to the United Nations demanding that Francesca Albanese, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories, be fired, claiming she continues to spew hatred, anti-Semitism, and incite violence. Can you talk about how Israel continues to challenge the UN and its decisions today?
Yes, it's
both by using these tactics of accusations of anti-Semitism against UN mechanisms like the Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights Situation in the Occupied Territories, now Francesca Albanese, but before it, Professor Michael Link, and before it, Professor Richard Falk, and before it, Judge Dugard, John Dugard. It does so against Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, when they come out with detailed documentation and legal analysis of the situation in Palestine as that of apartheid, which is a crime against humanity that both states and the United Nations have a responsibility, an obligation to tackle. It does so against, for example, Palestinian human rights defenders and organizations, accusing them of anti-Semitism because of legitimate, factual criticism, factually based criticism of Israel's policies of systematic human rights violations, or when it comes to Palestinians like us in civil society, also accusations of terrorism that whenever there is criticism of Israel, it is either anti-Semitic or it is supportive of terrorism. And I think this tactic needs, it is exposed. It's, in my view, no longer working. And that the United Nations, at the highest level, from the Secretary General, including to member states, should really stand firm against these tactics. They should stand firm in supporting the mechanisms that are there, like the Special Rapporteurs, Francesca Albanese being one of them, but there are also others that come out and produce documentation reports exposing Israel's human rights violations. It should stand firm with the International Criminal Court in carrying out this open investigation that has been open for a long time without any kind of movement, as opposed to then the prosecutor moving on other situations very quickly when there are evidence produced of war crimes and crimes against humanity. So I think in response to this that, you know, let me say, Palestine is the litmus test of this international world order, of the rule of law, of human rights, of international law. If the world fails Palestine by giving in into these scare, bullying tactics by Israel, then it has failed in many, many other places around the world. If international law does not stand in Israel, in Palestine, and for Palestinians, if the crimes of apartheid, if systematic human rights violations are allowed to continue without any kind of accountability, then they can continue without any kind of accountability anywhere around the world. So really, I think it is that the international community needs to stand for the rights of Palestinians, but it also, when it does so stand for this international order that is the rule-based, international law-based world order.
Finally, Peter Beinart, you did not always hold the views you have. You have not always been as critical of Israel as you are today. We actually only have 30 seconds, but if you could explain what changed you.
I think it was just going and seeing for myself. I think, like many American Jews, I had been to Israel many times, and I still feel a great sense of connection and affection for Israeli Jews, some of whom are many friends and family. But when I first, too late in life, but started to actually see some realities on the West Bank of Palestinian existence, it began a process for me of realizing that, for me as someone who believes in liberal democracy and equality under the law and believes in Jewish ideals as I understand them, this was not something I could support.
Peter Beinart, we want to thank you for being with us, editor-at-large of Jewish Currents, Saleh Hijazi of the Palestinian Boycott National Committee, formerly with Amnesty International, and Munir Nusaiba, director of Human Rights Clinic at Al-Quds University in Jerusalem, here for what the UN is calling Nakba Day. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Heidi Boghossian, my co-host, and me, Marjorie Cohn, speak with Professor Ellen Yaroshevsky, an expert on ethics.
We examine recent revelations about lavish gifts to Clarence Thomas and how he is not bound by the Judicial Code of Ethics.
We will also talk with attorney Kath Rogers from the ACLU of Southern California.
To address a houseless crisis, California legislators have introduced constitutional amendment proposals to enumerate the right to housing in their state constitution. Stay with us. I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org. It has recently come to light that right-wing billionaire and GOP megadonor Harland Crow paid for decades of luxury travel, gifts, and family property for Clarence Thomas, a member of the U.S. Supreme Court. Crow sits on the board of the Neoconservative American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank that frequently files amicus briefs in pending Supreme Court cases. In 2019, Crow flew Thomas to Indonesia in his private jet and funded a 9-day island-hopping cruise aboard Crow's superyacht, a trip valued at more than $500,000, nearly double Thomas's annual salary. But in spite of the Ethics in Government Act's requirement that federal judges disclose gifts over $415, Thomas failed to file such a disclosure. In 2004, Thomas refused to recuse himself from a case in which Crow's real estate company was being sued, despite a federal law requiring federal judges to recuse themselves when their impartiality might reasonably be questioned. And in 2021 and 2022, Thomas failed to recuse himself from cases involving the January 6th insurrection and Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election, even though Thomas's wife Ginny was a prominent organizer of the Stop the Steal campaign. While a code of conduct binds lower federal court judges, members of the Supreme Court are bound by no such code of conduct. Here with us today to analyze this lack of accountability for members of the highest court in the land is Professor Ellen Yaroshevsky. She is the Howard Lichtenstein Professor of Legal Ethics and Director of the Monroe Friedman Institute for the Study of Legal Ethics at the Maurice A. Dean School of Law at Hofstra University. Ellen is the longstanding co-chair of the Ethics Advisory Committee of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers and the former co-chair of the American Bar Association's Ethics, Gideon, and Professionalism Committee of the Criminal Justice Section. Professor Yaroshevsky, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
The Code of Conduct for United States Judges, which binds only lower federal court judges, requires an independent judiciary. What are its main provisions?
Thank you for asking. Well, first of all, the Code, it's not a series of rules. They're principles. They're principles like a judge should uphold the integrity and the independence of the judiciary. The judge should avoid impropriety, appearance of impropriety, and perform the duties of the office fairly, impartially, and diligently. Those are what we call canons. And then each of those have various provisions. There are regulations that have been passed that are part of the code. The most important one, probably the most relevant ones for our purposes here, are financial ones. And so there are specific regulations about what judges should and should not do. And specifically, it says that the judge should comply with the restrictions on acceptance of gifts